Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, August 22nd, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I have a great show for you guys this week, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible, especially those of you who are patrons of the show, as it were, through www.patreon.com/talknerdy. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. It's a really great program where I can post the episodes, I can post you guys some extras, and you can pledge to support the show week after week. If you're interested in supporting financially so that we can continue to ensure that Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download for everyone who's interested, so that you can help me offset some of the costs of producing and promoting and booking the show all by my lonesome, I really appreciate it. And I want to give a special shout out for my biggest contributors this week: Phil T-Bear, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Rod Adams, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, and of course, Jeff Sewell. Thank you guys so, so very much. Another great way to support the show is to rate and review on iTunes or any of the other podcast software programs that you use. Also, you can visit the online store. I have just recently replenished. There are plenty of super cool t-shirts, leather goods like bookmarks and keychains, all handmade and absolutely beautiful. And of course, I just got a new shipment in of the custom one-of-a-kind hand-thrown Talk Nerdy mugs. They're really beautiful, so you should visit carasantamaria.com and check them out. All right, guys, I'm really excited. This week, I got to sit down with someone who is quickly becoming a good friend of mine, I think, and who I'm really just impressed with all of the advocacy and conservation work that she's doing. She's a California director of the National Wildlife Federation, and she just wrote a lovely, lovely book called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors: People and Wildlife Working It Out in California. She has so many great stories to tell. So without any further ado, here she is, Beth Pratt Bergstrom. Well, Beth, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's always fun to talk with you.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm really excited because I haven't seen you in a while.
Yep.
First of all, I've chatted with you before, both for one of the KCET episodes that we did about mountain lions. And also, you are so, have been so kind of instrumental and so helpful and so incredible with all of the work that Jason Goldman and Sarah Curtis and I are doing on SciComm Camp.
Oh, you guys rock. And that was such a fun conference last year, and it's coming up this year.
Yes. Yeah? So you were our keynote last year, and everybody loved the stories you had to tell, especially about P22, which we will totally get to. This year, we're really excited because our keynote is going to be Caitlin Doty, who, do you know her?
When she wrote that, I was like, wow, what, you know, I like to see that, you know, you're upping the ante every year.
No. But she is, she's really awesome. She's, you know, I think another strong female, which I love that we have female voices. And she does like mortuary science. So it'll be kind of cool to
that's
talk
awesome.
About. Mountain lions and death.
Yes.
They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, sure.
A little bit. Well, cool. So obviously a lot of people know you as the mountain lion lady.
Yep.
And the reason for that is, what is your exact title at the National Wildlife, is it Federation?
Yeah, Federation, yeah. Not Cougar Lady, but yeah, it's California Director for the National Wildlife Federation. So I oversee their conservation work all over the state, but obviously LA is where I do a lot of my work. So
one of your passion projects has been for a species that's obviously, I think, very special, very charismatic here in California, here in Los Angeles, and that is the mountain lion.
Yes.
A.K.A. Cougar, A.K.A.
Puma. You know, it actually holds the record for the number of names in the English language.
So weird.
Yeah, I know. Because, well, it used to be so widespread. You know, it used to be everywhere. So, but yeah, I don't know how you can't love mountain lions. They're just incredibly magnificent creatures. But what I love about California is we do value them. You know, we're the only state in the country that voted by ballot measure. This wasn't legislation that they can't be hunted. So they're especially protected species here. And I'd say overall, you know, not everybody loves them on the landscape, but overall, especially LA, that the second largest city in the country says, we want P22, we want mountain lions here, is something that I just celebrate daily. I think it's just such a great story and a testament to that people do love wild things.
You know, maybe it's because of people like you that my introduction to the fact that we have these pumas, mountain lions, cougars, what's the other one? Panthers.
Panthers, yeah. Yeah, catamounts. You can go down the list.
Many. Maybe it really is a testament to you that, I don't know, just ever since I became aware of the fact that this is part of our landscape, the idea that we wouldn't want them here is beyond me. That somebody would be like, we should kill the panther. Like, that's crazy to me. It just seems like, obviously, this is such a charismatic, I mean, it's a big cat. We mm-hmm. think of those as only existing, like, in Africa.
Exactly. And again, I think there's something going on in LA especially, but California in general, you know, that ballot measure was placed in 1990, but it had its origins in the 60s, and it was bipartisan, too. It was supported by Ronald Reagan, so, you know. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that, and the world is watching, too. I mean, I think, especially when P22 munched on the koala bear, and there was, you know, some minimal calls for his relocation, but the majority of people said, no way, we want this cat here. He is a part of our neighborhood. He is a part of the landscape. You know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they all wrote, you know, some articles saying, wow, what's going on in LA that they're okay with a admittedly dangerous mm-hmm. wild predator in its midst. So I'm with you. I think a lot of people in LA, which does seem surprising to the outside world, is like, why not?
Yeah.
This is his home. But it is a value shift, and it is not, you know, something typical you'd find in the rest of the country.
You know, that's true, because when my colleague Derek Shore at KCET did kind of a companion-y story about coyotes, you know, I did a mountain lion story that featured you. He did a story about coyotes and visited some towns in Los Angeles that have a lot of coyote sightings. The mentality is very different. A lot of people are like, I have the right to shoot on sight. I don't want them to threaten my dogs. I don't want them in my neighborhood. And to me, I mean, that's also a charismatic animal. It's a wild dog. It's beautiful, and we should share the landscape with them. But there are a lot of people that are like, I do not want coyotes anywhere near me.
Yeah, there. I think for the most part, which does sound counterintuitive, people are more comfortable with a mountain lion living here than coyotes. But, you know, it's interesting. We, I think, still are a little ahead of the game in California on that. You know, you do have cities doing progressive non-lethal measures, working with groups like Project Coyote. But other cities like Chicago just passed a non-lethal ordinance, and they have coyotes there. But coyotes require a little more from us. I think that's why, you know, mountain lions, for the most part, P22, you know, unless he decides to take a nap in someone's house, you know, which he does once in a while, he largely stays out of sight. You know, he's really going after deer, where coyotes are, and they're ghost cats. They're introverts. They don't like to be around people.
Yeah.
Where coyotes are very adaptable. They will come in. If we leave food out, they will come into our yard. So I think, you know, the sort of mixed reaction that we get around coyotes is we have to be a little more responsible, not leave pet food out. You know, if you have animals, like I have 2 cats and 4 dogs. My cats are indoor because I have coyotes in my yard. So I think that is, you know, the coyotes require a little more for us, so we have a little more mixed feelings about
them. That's true. You know, my dog is about the size of a cat.
Yep.
Maybe smaller. I definitely have to watch him even when he's in my own backyard, because if I don't, that he could become a snack. I live very close to, basically in Griffith Park. There are coyotes. When I first looked at this house with my realtor, there was a coyote sleeping on the front porch when we showed up at the house. It was crazy. And granted, he was not well. He had mange. You could tell that he wasn't, you know, like middle of the day hanging out on a front porch. But just last week, there was a California striped racer on my porch. So apparently my porch loves wildlife.
Yeah, I think very wildlife friendly. That's
so
excellent.
Crazy. But yeah, I mean, you do have to kind of keep an eye out. But it also, I think, is very telling to the entire sort of genus that the creatures are, or even beyond the genus. You know, mountain lions are cats. Cats are not domesticatable very easily. Even the domestic cat is not very domestic.
Yeah.
Coyotes are dogs. think about how easy it was to domesticate the dog. They'll come to you. They'll try and eat your scraps. They, you know, but they are also wild, and they will eat your face.
Exactly.
You have to be careful. But there's a reason, I think, that they're much less tentative around people. It's part of their nature. They're pack animals.
Yeah, they're smart. They're adaptable. Mm. And we've been trying to kill them for, you know, over 100 years.
Mm,
and
so sad.
And it's sad. And it also is a testament to their survival as a species that they're, you know, in fact, they're increasing in numbers. And, you know, coexistence, which I preach, it's not always easy. And I think the coyote is a prime example of that. But I think we still, having them on the landscape can be, again, much like the mountain lion, something that is intrinsically valued. But, you know, especially here with pets, food sources, if we are responsible neighbors, like I write about in the book, what they did for bears in Yosemite, where bears were getting food from cars and causing all this property damage, and they were having to euthanize bears, and that was their solution. That was the only solution they had. But once they, you know, sort of shifted the blame, so to speak, and said, we can't blame a bear for being a bear, but us as humans, we're the ones who have to fix. And once they did, the incidents went away. And I think that's where, you know, especially the coyote, if we all took responsibility, did not put pet food out, kept, you know, our small pets indoors or under a watchful eye, at least at key times, they would stop, you know, they would adapt very quickly away from seeing us as food sources in yards.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, they're smart creatures. Yeah. And just like you said in Yosemite, you know, I just visited quite recently, and it's true. I had never been to kind of bear country, and I was a little bit afraid. Even though black bears in that area are like not very scary,
Pretty,
you know. But it's everywhere. There's signs posted like, "Do not feed them. Do not leave food out. Put all of your food in a bear box if you're camping." You just don't give them the opportunity. Right. And now the funny thing is, if you don't use your bear box, you're more likely to get probably quote assaulted by marmots than you
are.
Yeah,
it's true.
They're going to come eat all your Doritos.
Yeah, are very those marmots are great. I mean, I'm so, you know, I worked in Yosemite for a decade, and I am so trained in that you know, I'll be in LA and be cleaning out my car of any food and thinking, wait a minute, I don't have to do this.
Yeah,
here.
It's but not you know, rip into your car.
It becomes second nature to do that. And I live in, you know, I live up near Yosemite, although I'm down here, like, you know, I have a second home down here. But my trash is secured. I don't, you know, leave pet food out. My animals come in at night. And you know, the bears up there, we don't have the grizzlies. So obviously they're not. And the only person to ever die from wildlife in Yosemite was from a mule deer. So
are you serious?
Yeah. Yes. Isn't that hilarious?
What did they do? They stabbed them with their antlers?
Kick. They are kickers. Yes. You know, it looks cute to pet the mule deer.
Because the deer do, like, they're very bold. They'll get close to you.
You know, it really is the ungulates that, like, when I worked in Yellowstone, the other Y Park, you know, people are like, oh my God, weren't you scared of the grizzlies and the wolves? No. The elk and the deer. I mean, those are the guys that are cranky.
I did when we went to Yosemite. We actually went camping kind of in it was Sabrina Lake. So it was like an hour from Yosemite, kind of in the Sierras. And then we drove up to Yosemite for the day. It was beautiful. But I remember telling all my friends, like, I'm scared to go. I've never been around bears. And ever since I saw the Revenant, and they were like different bears.
Yeah, different bears. Yeah. You know, again, I don't know if it's the California laid back attitude, but you look at, again, we haven't even had a person die from a black bear attack in California in, like, you know, the last 100 years in recent history. They do, I mean, again, they're wild and the potential is there to be dangerous, but they do seem less aggressive here. Maybe it's the California sunshine. That is not typical of the rest of the country if you look at where bear attacks occur, even with black bears. I don't know what's going on here. It is very interesting.
Yeah, because I always just thought the common understanding was like, oh, black bears just aren't aggressive like grizzlies, but maybe it's just California black bears.
They can be.
They're smoking like the medical marijuana.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if they're finding those, you know, marijuana farms. And you know, they can be aggressive.
That's good to know.
Other parts of the country, not, you know, again, they're just laid back here. I'm not sure what's going on.
I learned so much about mountain lions from you. I can't wait to kind of share, I think, with the listeners some of the really interesting things that I've learned. But you mentioned your book, so we have to make sure everybody knows that they can read all about them because you literally just published this. Is it even available yet?
It is, yeah. August 1st was the official publication date. So it's in every book, Barnes & Noble, I've checked, in bookstore. It's there. Amazon, you can get it online.
That's so
exciting. Yeah, it's very exciting. And all the proceeds, I don't get any royalties. I wrote it for the mountain lions and the bears. They all go back to conservation for NWF. So, yeah.
Okay, first of all, that's insane.
It is. My father said, he's like, are you insane? He's like,
you did all this work to write this beautiful book and you're not making any money on it.
No.
The whole thing is going towards the National Wildlife Federation and towards basically saving these really beautiful cats.
Exactly. All the it's staying in California. So all the projects that I work on here, like the Save LA Cougars, and we have which mentioned in the book, a gray fox corridor in Silicon Valley, pica projects. So it's all going back to that. And that's really why I wrote it. You know, I there was a few reasons. I wanted to celebrate the good news. There's so much bad news, in conservation, in the environment.
It's true. If you follow a lot of conservation blogs, it's like, wow, this is like a real bummer.
Yeah. And I was getting burnt out after 25 years. So it was like, wait a minute, we need to get back to the good news that really inspires us, because I'm guessing you and I know myself didn't get interested in wildlife because someone when we were age six said, you know, climate change is, you know, wiping out species, or the Clean Water Act is.
Yeah, no. You get into it because you see it.
You see it. Or you watch, like for me, it was Born Free and Mutual of Omaha and Jack Cousteau. You get inspired by the stories. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And then it seemed likely that if it's going to inspire people, let's have the book also do some good by giving back to these conservation
That's programs. Incredible. Mm-hmm. So the book is called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is such a great title. So,
yeah, Matt, Heyday came up with that. Malcolm Margolin, then founder of Heyday, came up with it. And I said, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That says it all.
That says it all. And of course, on the cover, there's this beautiful, I should say, portrait of P22 by, what's his name, Steve Winter?
Steve Winter, who we cannot thank him enough. Talk about giving back. He is an international photographer for National Geographic. He spent 14 months getting these portraits of P22 in Griffith Park, which, you know, talk about patience. They're all remote cameras, so they had to set that up. You know, there's the cover, which is the city lights, but also the one I think people are really familiar with is the Hollywood sign with P22. He has donated the use of these images for the book, for our campaign, which for a nonprofit, we could never afford images like this. So,
oh, for sure. When we did the coverage on it for the KCET show I work on, for SoCal Connected, that's public TV. We can't buy music and images all that often. And when we do, we have such a measly budget. And of course, we had permission to use these images.
Wonderful. He is so wonderful.
And they're so good at telling the story.
The cover of the book says it all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's P22. There's LA. You don't, you know, again, we're used to seeing mountain lion or any wildlife photos in more pristine nature settings. So I think for a lot of people, it challenges you right away. Like, wait a minute, why are there city lights with this mountain lion?
It's so great. And he's like, yeah, whatever.
Whatever. Yeah, I'm here.
And so we keep saying P22. We should make sure that people who don't know, even though he is kind of an international celebrity.
He is a celebrity. Yeah.
But it's a weird name.
It is a weird name. Yeah. Right? So P stands for Puma, which is one of the 40, you know, names for mountain lions. And 22, he's the 22nd mountain lion that the National Park Service has tagged in their study. I think they're up to like 53 now. It's not that there's 53 out there. Some have died, you know, through the course of their study.
And there's obviously more mountain lions than that.
There's more mountain lions than that. Not much more. I mean, they estimate in the Santa Monica Mountains, although nobody knows. But based on these mountain lions are extremely self-regulating. They have huge territories, 250 square miles for males. They estimate about 10 to 15, which isn't a lot, you know, from like the Santa Monica Mountain coast to, you know, Griffith Park.
So, and that's a huge area.
It's a huge area. Yeah. So that's why we don't see them. There's not a huge amount of them. But he's the 22nd cat. And there was some calls for a while, you know, let's rename him. But, you know, he's a celebrity. It's his name. Plus, I didn't want to have to change my tattoo.
Yeah.
Some of the names were, I don't know, some were kind of funny, although Puma Thurman was one.
Very Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love it. So, but didn't they vote? And
they
literally
voted P22 overwhelmingly.
Voted P22.
Yeah, I mean, it's his name now, you know, so.
And so he's obviously, I think, very special. Obviously, there are more mountain lions than P22, as the name implies. He's number 22.
Right.
You said they're up to 50. There's a whole, you have a beautiful poster from NWF that's like the Cougars of LA.
Cougars of LA. The cats, yeah. Not
the real Cougars. And they've all got different personalities. And, you know, there's male Cougars and female Cougars. But P22 is special.
He's special. Yeah, you know, we tend to think of, you know, we think of our pets as individuals, right? Our dogs and our cats. But I think we're just trained probably because of science for so long to think of animals as generalities of groups. But all animals, including mountain lions, are individuals. They have personalities. Not every mountain lion would be doing as well in Griffith Park. You know, yeah. P22 is someone who is a, you know, I'm okay with urban living. I'm okay with people around. I'm not, you know, I've worked it out. So, and I have, it's kind of scary, but if you show me one of the P's, I can usually pick it out like, oh, that's P45.
That's
the male.
Hilarious.
But they do have, you know, different personalities. They're individuals. You know, we've been taught that it's wrong to anthropomorphize, and I don't think it is. I think it's wrong to anthropomorphize the wrong way, but they are similar to us, not exactly like us. But as we see, you know, these books are coming out that fish have emotional lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not the separateness that we have been, you know, sort of taught for so long. It's more a spectrum where there are things we can relate to with them, and not exactly, you know, as Jeff Sikich, the biologist on the Mountain Lion Project, who we help support for the Park Service, you know, would point out to me on early drafts of the book, you know, mountain lions don't date, you know, they're not lonely. And I said, no, I know, but, you know, so, you know, you, but I think most people know that when you over anthropomorphize, I think that, you know, that's to do a point. People know.
But there is kind of that line, isn't there? You've probably had a little bit of bumping up with the scientists.
Absolutely.
And they're like, oh, I'm really
uncomfortable
with
that. Yep.
It's like, well, yeah, but that's the role, I think, of like a strong science communicator and an advocate is to kind of go in between. There are rules and there are regulations and there are kind of, I don't know, traditions within science that were very conservative and don't want to break. And then there are ways to get the public excited.
Right. And there is a balance. And I do push back. You know, I work for a very old traditional organization. And I know, you know, carrying a mountain lion cutout around gives some of our, you know, really good scientists, but traditional ones a little pause. But, you know, I do think we have done a disservice in being, you know, even like the P name. I mean, I know why people want to rename them because that, you know, it's a very scientific, rigid name.
Yeah.
But I think it's taken on his personality. But, you know, we do a disservice, I think, in, you know, keeping an arm's length for wildlife to survive. And that's why, like, I'm a convert now to this urban interface, like with P22 and other wildlife. We have to have day-to-day relationships with them. It doesn't mean petting them or feeding them.
Or taking selfies with them.
Or taking selfies, unless it's a cutout.
Yeah.
Unless it's a cutout, but don't take selfies. But we have to have a day-to-day relationship where we are familiar with them. If you know about mountain lion behavior, you're going to be much less likely to have a conflict with them because you're going to be less afraid. You're going to understand how they behave. I mean, if you know about coyote behavior and how they think and feel, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be able to coexist better. I thought one of the best examples of coexistence recently, did you catch that video of the bears having a bath in Lake Tahoe?
Oh, yes.
You know, I was watching it just going, oh, God, this. When is the person going to go up and pet the
Like,
the
look,
cub?
They look so fun.
Or
like,
take
from the
selfie.
Window, from through the window.
But it worked, right? The bears walked down the beach. People stayed at a distance.
Which is
and
great.
Then the bears walked back up the beach. So, you know, obviously the potential for something ending badly was there, but it didn't. Everybody, the bears were respectful, the people were respectful, and boy, you know, everybody wins.
Do you remember there was a crazy video that went around of actually a mountain lion running along? It was almost like a jogging trail that was like a bridge.
Oh, yes, footbridge. It was in the Everglades.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. And this woman, so of course they call them panthers in Florida, right? And this woman was videotaping out of the blue. She wasn't videotaping the mountain lion.
No.
She was just videotaping. And it ran by, and she did exactly the right thing. She stood firm. She didn't scream. She just let it run by her. And then, of course, was like, oh, my God.
I loved her narration. Oh, my God. Oh, my, you know. You know. But, you know, I think she, you know, again, she did the right thing. And it showed the mountain lion just wanted to get the heck out of there.
Yeah, he wasn't interested
in
her.
He was not like, I'm going to hunt. And that's, I think, something to keep in mind is – mountain lions don't see us as prey. They don't. The ones that have attacked, and again, it's pretty rare, it's usually young ones who are just like
learning.
You know, teenage troublemakers, or they're stressed. They're in a new territory. They can't get out because of roads. They're like, you know, we need – so they just haven't figured it out. But for the most part, they don't see us as prey.
Yeah.
And what an encounter for her because
– incredible.
I'm sure she was – I would have been scared. I know mountain lion behavior. If a mountain lion was running right towards me, I would be scared but appreciative. And I love that she took it in that spirit.
She did.
Know?
She was so – so brave about it. Because the truth is, they don't see us as prey, but probably a way to maybe inch them that direction would be to act like prey.
To run. To run. If she had run, you know, they're cats. Yep. Those of us who have cats, they behave like cats. You know, oh boy, what's that? You
know? Yeah, I'm pretty hungry. Yeah. That thing that's running from me doesn't want to get eaten.
Is inciting my, you know, predator-prey response.
Yeah, but Jeff Sikich, I mean, he taught me when I was interviewing him. Puff up, look bigger than you are, make loud, scary noise, like be dominant.
Yes, it's not like bears. We're taught to play dead. And even with bears, it's a little more complex than play dead. But for the most part, you know, if a bear is charging you or something, you want to play dead and remain intrusive. Exact opposite with mountain lions. And I tell people, it's not, you know, there's no hard rules with wildlife.
Sure.
But for the most part, if you see one, you're probably going to be okay. They want the stealth, quick kill, you know, or injure, you know, they're not like, so if you see one, you have an opportunity to make that situation be, end well for both. Eye contact, make sure you keep eye contact, look big. If you have a bag, pick it up, yell, you know, pick up a stick. And mountain lions don't want, you know, they want the easy deer, you know, you know, takedown. So if you look like you're going to be a problem, they don't, you know, they're not going to want much to do with you.
Yeah. Usually carnivores don't eat other carnivores. It's not that interesting to them. They eat, you know, harder. Docile it's hard meat
work.
Eaters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's hard work, you know?
It's true. They don't want to fight.
Yep.
They just want to eat.
They just want to eat. Yeah.
And so that's what P22 actually does feed on for the most part here in Griffith is mule deer.
Yeah. They've done studies. It's, I forget what the percentage is, but it's, you know, somewhere in the 90% mule deer. Some coyotes. In fact, you know, I write about in my book when Miguel and his team were out there and, you know, they wrote a blog saying, hey, it's a coyote. You know, we found that he ate a coyote. So raccoons, you know, some of the smaller. For the most part, it's not worth their time to go after the smaller prey. So they,
It probably doesn't keep them satiated very
long. Doesn't keep them satiated. So they're really going to go after the deer. I mean, mountain lions and deer are, it is their meal. So they're always going to choose that. But of course, you know, if they can't get a deer, they'll go after, you know, smaller prey like raccoons or stuff. So,
and is it thought that, because I'm not sure if people remember, but, you know, obviously the story, we're totally working backward here, and we'll get, I think, to the beautiful, you know, trial and error of P22 making it to Griffith Park. But the story is that he left home in the mountains of Santa Monica, eventually made it to Griffith Park, and is basically stuck there.
Yes.
And he's all alone.
He's all alone.
In a very small area.
So I said before in the interview, 250 square miles is the average home range for a male mountain lion. He's in 8 square miles. It's the smallest known home range ever recorded for a mountain lion. And also, mountain lions, they don't den like African lions. I mean, they really will make a kill and go 25 miles to the next kill or 5 miles, whatever. They really do use their whole territory. Mm-hmm. So he's a remarkable cat for a number of reasons. One, he's surviving in this very small space, mainly because in those home ranges are defined by prey availability.
Okay.
So, you know, the deer in Griffith Park haven't had a predator for probably 100 years or however.
Yes, they're just all sitting ducks.
Oh, so they're just like, oh, you know, it's like fish in a barrel for P22. Although I'm sure by this point, he's been there since 2012, they're probably learning like, oh, okay, we might have a mountain lion here that it might eat us. But he's got, so far, they're monitoring it, you know, plenty to eat. So he doesn't have to move on, but he would probably want to. So we celebrate him because of his remarkable journey. Like, I mean, he crossed 2 major freeways. The author Mary Ellen Hannibal, who is a friend, I love the word she used in a blog. He had the gumption to march into LA. And so we celebrate him for like going through these extreme lengths to just find a home. And he's surviving, and he's surviving with 10 million people who visit that park and not causing any problems. I mean, I can't even, that is just so remarkable to me. But he's not a success story. Ideally, you know, if the crossing had been in place when he was, that we're trying to build when he come of age, he'd probably be up north. But it does beg the question. It brings up this interesting, you know, I was a national park person. I worked in Yellowstone and Yosemite for most of my career. When I first heard about P22, I was just like, oh my God, he shouldn't be there. How can he even be there? But when I visited Griffith Park, I really did have a career and life-changing epiphany with, you know, Jeff Sikich took me on a tour. And it just dawned on me, like, well, who am I to judge? I mean, if that's the only way he can live, then, and since we're paving over their habitat at a rate that is unprecedented, what choice do they have? I had a scientist who I work with, who I respect, you know, we just disagree, you know, thinks that, you know, animals should not be in human spaces at all, and was telling me, like, you know, there's a study done that humans are more stressed in cities, or, you know, where they find them, or people spaces. I said, of course they are more stressed in LA.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Who isn't? But on the other hand, the choice is they get to live or not exist or be more stressed. I mean, most of us would choose to live.
To live, right? Exactly.
And I think it's the same with animals. If they're willing to adapt, we should be.
Mm. And there was, you know, something compelled P22, whether it was the natural occurrence of coming of age, realizing that you don't have a home anymore, you don't have a place, the other
right.
males are threatening you. There's too many mountain lions in a small space. I've got to disperse. I've got to go somewhere.
Right.
And he chose to go the way he went, which
he
is crazy because he basically, as you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
like walked through Beverly Hills.
I know. And nobody saw him. I mean, it's just, can you imagine? You know, he's just walking through the manicured lawns in Beverly Hills. Nobody knows.
Lifting his leg on a mailbox.
Yeah.
It's like so weird.
Exactly.
And, you know, eating along the way, I would assume. Uh-huh. And eventually, and like you said, cross freeways, which, as we know, many mountain lions die that way.
Yes.
And it's so lucky. Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's in Griffith. For people who don't know Griffith, if you've never visited LA, it's sort of on the northeastern side of the city. It's very close to where I live. And it's where the observatory is. It's where the Los Angeles Zoo is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place called Travel Town.
It's pony rides.
There are pony rides.
Golf.
There's
yeah.
a golf course. So, mm-hmm. like, even though it's a national, or it's not a national park, it's a park that's owned by the city.
Right.
A lot of it's developed.
Yeah, even in that 8 square miles, Miguel, mm-hmm. You know, one of the biologists who found the first, you know, picture of P22, he likes to point out that even in the 8 square miles, a lot of that's developed.
Yeah, so, there's a freaking golf course.
So he's an even less than that,
yeah.
and that he's navigating that. You walk around Griffith Park. I had never been until I came down and took the tour with Jeff, you know, and learned about P22. And yeah, I mean, I want to stress, this is not on the outskirts of L.A. This is in LA. Mm-hmm. That's what's so remarkable. And it is a highly peopled landscape. But it does, oddly enough, if you go for a hike, you can feel like you're out there. Because,
you can.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I'm hiking in Griffith, which I do all the time because I can walk to
yeah,
my trail,
right,
I'm always thinking, where is he? You
right.
know? Like, he must be like under a rock somewhere, under a tree, because I've actually been to some of the places. I was lucky enough. Miguel Orodeñada?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, works for the Natural History Museum. I also interviewed him for that SoCal Connected story. I was lucky enough for him to point out where some of the camera traps are and to show me where some of the actual pictures have been taken of. So I'm literally like, I'm walking where P22 has walked before. There's not many places he could go.
Nope.
But you don't realize it. When you hike to the top of Griffith and you look across, you're like, well, there's Burbank.
Right.
And like on that side is Glendale. And over there's North Hollywood. Like it's not like nature keeps going.
No.
You can see all the freeways carving it out.
It's an island.
Yeah.
And you know, we're seeing that not with Griffith Park. The study that the National Park Service has done since 2002 for all the mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains, I mean, they have a map where they have all the mountain lions their study, and their home ranges are absolutely defined by these freeways. They are islands. And the interesting thing that they're finding, and, you know, we talk about this crossing and we use the mountain lion and P22 as the poster child because mm-hmm. everybody loves mountain lions. They're cute, they're beautiful.
Well, they're really cute as kittens.
They're really, oh my God, the blue
so
eyes. But what they're finding in their study is animals like salamanders
mm-hmm.
and birds are also impacted by these freeways cross-cutting territory and creating islands where the genetic diversity is just plummeting. So it's our development and these roads are impacting all wildlife, you
yeah.
know, not just these big cats.
That's something we don't think about. You know, the mm-hmm. story of P22, I think, is really profound and it's really meaningful. And I think it speaks to a lot of people who live in LA, especially because you see the news when P22 is sleeping under somebody's house and the news cameras happen to get a hold of it. And you go like, oh, I know that neighborhood. I've seen that street sign. You're like, but it's right there. Or you think about it, you know, he's living in Griffith and you're hiking in Griffith and you're like, holy crap, he's probably like sleeping under my feet somewhere,
yeah.
you know, because, you know, he's sleeping during the day and out of the way. But it's meaningful in that way. But and we talk about his story, and we talk about, oh, he can't get out, or if he does get out, he might get hit by a car. But what if he decides he will? Then it's a big risk he's going to take. We don't think about the fact that his story is a tiny piece of a bigger ecosystem.
Exactly.
Right? And why mm-hmm. would he want to get out? So that he could get laid. And why would he want to get laid? To improve the diversity of the genetic line of these mountain lions.
You just hit it. I mean, he does need to get laid. And mm-hmm. it's not just, you know, to have fun. I mean, if that is the problem and why these mountain lions, although mountain lions are doing fine pretty much in California, they're not endangered, they're not threatened, but this population is. If males cannot come in and out from other territories, the genetic diversity, which they're finding, is the lowest right now they've seen in Western populations of cougars, and is approaching the low bar of the Florida panther, who's almost extinct.
And the reason for that extinction mm-hmm. is, of course, habitat encroachment, all of those right. things, but also just the fact that a species can't survive when it becomes too inbred.
No, you get things like, kink tails, just one testes, things like that. And that's what we're just sort of, waiting for to happen here. It hasn't happened yet, but when they do the, genetic testing, the values are getting lower and lower.
Yeah, when I try to look at these Santa Monica Mountains, mountain lion, like family trees, they mm-hmm. get really confusing.
They do, because you have like, P12 mating with his granddaughter. Yeah. So these are behaviors, and you get much more interspecies conflict because they can't get out of each other way. So like where I live up near Yosemite, we have mountain lions. They don't come into contact with each other as much because they have much more territory. I mean, we have roes up there, but not, to the point where they, can't navigate them.
Yeah, like nature is connected to nature.
Yeah, up there you at least have a lot of protected land, like national forests. So they have at least, if not a perfect time, at least an easier time. Mm-hmm. You don't see the inbreeding there. You don't see the interspecies conflict, at least to the extent that you have here. So, what we're doing is our roads are just, hemming these lions in, and for a number of reasons. It could spell the doom of this population. If you just have, there's only three males in the Santa Monica Mountains, maybe two. They're not sure if P45 replaced P12. They're still.
Oh,
looking.
We don't know if one of them's
exactly.
Still around.
P45 sort of came on the scene, and it was like, oh, who's this big guy? But that's not a lot, and we lost four mountain lions. I think it was last year, and so you get a couple more taken out by the roads or rodenticides. We haven't even touched on that. Mm-hmm. Game over. Like, there's no males coming in successfully, and you're going to have a population just collapse. So there's an urgency here, which is why we are pushing this crossing, that we want to get this built, because although they're holding their own right now, it could deteriorate very quickly.
Yeah. We talk about P22 a lot, and I think it's because in so many ways he really serves as a poster child, like literally in the meaning of that term. And he's also on posters.
He's on posters. He's a literal poster
child. He's a literal poster. But when we talk about all these things that you mentioned, and we'll continue to talk about, he's experienced all of them.
Yes,
right?
He
exemplifies the risks.
Of living in an urban setting. Yeah. So of course he crossed the roads and somehow made it. And I think he's figured out, like, I am not doing that again. I mean, most of us don't want to get on the 101, right?
No, so, can you imagine crossing like the 405 on foot?
No. Even at 2 a.m, that place has cars
whizzing
by.
It's dangerous. Yeah, I can see the 5 from my window. I don't know if you can see it
up there.
Oh,
there it is. Yep.
And I mean, there are times when I'm sitting out on the balcony looking at the stars, or observing with my telescope, and it's nonstop in the middle of the night.
Never ends. I had to learn LA traffic coming down here, and I learned, it just never ends.
Hey, you're so, like, how is it rush hour at 2 a.m.?
Yeah, exactly. or like 10 a.m. Like, where are these people going?
So
isn't
weird.
Rush hour over? But yeah, so he exemplifies that these wildlife, and not just mountain lions, we see all sorts of roadkill that can't get across these roads. The human, the potential for human conflict, mm-hmm. and I think he's worked that one out. And I think we've worked that one out. And that is such a great, sort of team spirit. But also the other dangers, like, the anticoagulant rodenticides, which we, rat poison is their more common term. And I think most people, once they learn what they do, are like, okay, we won't do that. But you want to get rid of rats, so you put out rat poison. Well, it doesn't just kill the rats. You have a coyote that comes and eats the rat who hasn't died yet, P22 eats the coyote, and these things are bioaccumulators, which means they increase in dose as they go up the food chain. And what happened to P22? Another poster child. In fact, they, you know, groups like Poison Free Malibu use his mange photo.
Oh, it's so visual.
When that came out, it was heartbreaking. I mean, here's this beautiful cat that Steve Winter, you know, put in these National Geographic photos, and here he is drooling with spotty fur.
His face
whiskers.
Was like fat. Like, yeah. It was like weirdly swollen, and his eyes looked like they were almost swollen shut.
Yeah, whiskers drooping, you know, hair kind of mangy.
Yeah, those patches of just like gross looking fur. It was so sad. Like, he looked brutally ill.
He looked terribly ill.
Yeah. Yep.
And so the Park Service luckily was able to treat him, but he could be exposed any time again. So,
and he's a celebrity. Like, the Park Service, you know, he had a collar. They could find him. They could trank him and then treat him and then set him up. But, like, not every little raccoon gets that kind of special treatment.
No,
it's
and
so sad.
Two of the mountain lions in their study did die recently. I mean, there's more, but two did die recently. One over in near the Agoura Hills, Thousand Oaks area, and I should know the number off the top of my heart. It was either P33 or... But
nobody will know the deal.
Yeah, nobody has to. I could probably nobody tracks him as much as we do. But it was one of the P's in the '30s. Her nickname was Smokey, and she was somebody who was well known over that area. And yes, she basically bled internally to death.
Yeah, that's the other thing that people don't realize. Like P22. He had the external symptoms, so researchers could tell when they saw the camera trap photos.
And he's the most tracked and photographed cat.
Yes, so they're so aware of him.
Yeah, like other cats in the San Juan Mountains, they don't see as much.
And some don't even have collar, you know?
Exactly.
It's like, if we don't know that cat exists, how do we know if it's gotten hurt? But if the dose is high enough, or if their immune system is weakened enough, or whatever the case may be, it literally is a hemorrhagic disease.
Oh, it's a terrible way to go.
It's like, it's like Ebola. Like, their organs start. It's so sad.
And yeah, these cats, you know, the challenges they face, the struggles they have to survive, and that they do it, you just have to applaud them. And like, that's one that's so easily solvable.
And it's one that's so shit, because it's so just like directly our fault. Like, nobody poisoned that cat or, you know, the things that cat ate, except a person.
Right.
Only people put out rodenticide.
And this is where, again, I will credit LA with taking a lead. I mean, we haven't, you know, perfected here by any means. There's a lot of rat poison that needs to get, but I don't know any other major paper in the country that has a mountain lion beat. And I don't know any other major paper in the country that would run the headline when that cat, and again, I might get the number wrong, that said, we killed the mountain lion P33 or whatever it was, and rat poison was our weapon. I mean, I sent that to my colleagues all across the country, and they're like, wow, that was the LA Times headline? So it's great, because we are, although we haven't solved it totally yet, I mean, that is, again, another like LA value that is something at least that's hopeful that, you know, I mean, A, that a mountain lion even got covered from dying from rat poison in a major paper, and two, that we covered it, not, you know, mountain lion, you know, died, but that we did it. That's pretty remarkable to me.
Yeah. And you know, the truth of the matter is, with all of these things, when it comes to urban wildlife and coexisting, it's a trade-off, right? There are risks and benefits we have to measure. I look at you, you're a normal person. You're wearing a t-shirt. You're wearing deodorant. You're not a big crazy hippie who thinks that like we shouldn't have freeways, and who thinks that, you know, we should just all like have horse and buggy to coexist.
Right.
Like, obviously there are things that are tough. We have freeways, and the freeways are where they are. We're not going to move them for these animals. But there have been some ingenious solutions, or at least mitigations a little bit to these big problems, haven't there?
Yeah. And, you know, I just had this discussion with the wonderful friends I'm staying with who are big volunteers in our Save LA Cougars campaign. And they were teasing me for being vegan, actually. And, and I said, you know, I'm not judging anybody. But and honestly, like, even being vegan, you have an impact, right? I mean, it is impossible to live on this planet and not have an impact, you know, unless you literally just stood naked and, you know, did
unless
nothing.
You were like literally living in the forest.
Yeah. But even then, you're stepping on plants, you're having to. So you have an impact. And yeah, I'm not your typical tree hugger. Of course, you know, I have a biology undergrad and I'm a very passionate environmentalist, but I have an MBA. I love capitalism. I think businesses should have a chance to thrive, and we have to live in this world. We have to drive. We have to fly. We have to. But we can do it, not just with wildlife, but with other sustainability. But, of course, we're addressing wildlife in this talk. We can do it in ways that are accommodating so that we're not destroying all other life on the planet. So, yeah, we need freeways, but why not green up those freeways and have wildlife crossings like we're talking about? Other countries do it. And they don't have to be big things. They can be little culverts for frogs to cross under. Why can't we live more responsibly? Yeah, we need to build houses for people. Fine. Make sure there's enough green space. Make sure that you do teach people that if you don't want to attract coyotes or so that coyotes, you know, don't start, you know, coming into your yard. Don't leave pet food out. Don't do this. So there are ways to have it all in some respects. It, you know, it doesn't require that much sacrifice on our part to coexist. I mean, I have 4 dogs and 2 cats. I would be devastated if they got killed by a coyote or a mountain lion. But again, I have a predator-friendly fence. I don't let my dogs run loose except for the half acre that's fenced. They're inside at night. My cats don't go outside. I don't leave pet food. I don't leave trash. That's not a lot of sacrifice,
no.
You know, to sort of give wildlife a little chance to be successful.
And a lot of times we're not even talking about predators. I mean, they will come and go, but they're so rare. It's so rare that you're going to have, you know, coyotes or mountain lions like walking in and out of your yard, especially depending on where you live. If you're in the middle of the city, that's very rare.
Right.
But you don't think about the lizards and the snakes and the turtles and the birds and the bees and all the beautiful insects that ultimately create the food that, you know, these things then eat. And one thing I love that you guys do at the NWF is you help people certify their lawns, basically, their backyards to be a habitat.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best things we do. And I end the book. So the book is all these successful wildlife stories, and we talk about what regular people are doing, like or people like the Marines, or people you wouldn't expect. Mark Zuckerberg was making a home for foxes.
Oh, with the foxes.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that. That's another great story. But the take home, the last chapter is, here's what people are doing in their yards.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, yeah, you don't want a mountain lion living in your yard. But to help mountain lions, it's the little things. As E.O. Wilson said, I'm paraphrasing, it's the little things that make the ecosystem go. So if you want a healthy mountain lion population in the Santa Monica Mountains, what you can really do to help, aside from helping us build the wildlife crossing, is in your yard, you can plant milkweed for monarchs. You can put in a water source for birds to make sure that you have the biodiversity and replace some of the habitat that we have taken, because it's all wildlife that's stressed. When I do talks with kids, and kids get this intuitively, I'm like, imagine if you had to walk 20 miles a day to the grocery store to eat. Wouldn't that be hard? Oh, yeah. And imagine if you got to the grocery store and there wasn't any groceries. That's what we've done to this wildlife is, and we tend to think of big wildlife, but it really is the smaller ones that really need our help as well, is we've just taken away their food, their stopping places, you know, places that they can even live. And that's something you can do in an apartment balcony. I mean, you can put up a bird bath and a hanging milkweed garden in an apartment balcony.
And it's like, why wouldn't you want monarch butterflies in your
backyard?
You know, it's like, it's win-win. You're helping create habitat for them, create food sources for them. And they're giving back to you by like basically giving you free meditation, like free Zen yoga or something.
Yeah, you know? Right. Like, I mean, we should market it like that. Yeah. I like that. I'll have to. Yeah. Diane Ellis is one of the just regular people. She lives in a pretty small house. Does not have much of a backyard. And she, you know, she's on Facebook and you can follow her Monarch Watch every year. She's put milkweed in every small available space she has. And, she watches the monarch, you know, go from caterpillar to butterfly. And we get addicted. Like in my yard, I have a frog pond I put in, which has turned into, just a water source for anything that walks through the yard.
Yeah.
But I get so excited every year. It is zen, or it's just very peaceful when the tadpoles come and then they turn into little froglets. And then they I document them like a proud mom when the 200 tadpoles, sort of turn into frogs. And, you know, that's something that we all feel a connection to wildlife. I don't care what your political affiliation is. I joke like the Koch brothers, some of the worst environmental offenders I can think of. They'll stop if a bald eagle flies overhead.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that we all have sort of an instinctual connection to in a good way. We may sort of exhibit it differently, but we all are connected. So why not get more connected and have as many, especially these smaller critters that we can coexist with pretty easily in our yards? Why not make space for these small guys?
And just the conscientiousness, the stopping for a second and thinking about the fear or the squeamishness that sometimes we feel when we see a spider in the house, or there's a type of herp, like a lizard or something, or a snake. Like mm-hmm. when that snake was on my front porch, it was a big snake too. And we were like, whoa, when we first walked up, what did we do? We scooped up the dog so he wouldn't get close because mm-hmm. they're very bitey. They're not venomous, but they're bitey.
Right, they're bitey. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so just let it be.
Right.
Go in the back door. Keep an eye on it. Obviously, take pictures and put it up on
right,
iNaturalist.
Exactly. Put it up on iNaturalist.
Got to do that.
Absolutely.
And then he'll go away. He's just trying to keep cool.
He's just trying to keep cool. Yeah. You know, we can all relate to that. It's like he's trying to keep cool, or they're looking for food. And, you know, the good news is, you know, again, you give wildlife distance, usually it ends well. I don't know why I'm not squeamish. I think the only thing I'm squeamish about is ticks. But, even my husband jokes, like, you know, the spiders are taking over the house. I tend to be pretty, you know, unless they one started making a web over my sink. And I'm like, okay, you can't, you know.
I'm like, I got to get to my dishes.
And plus, they can be beneficial. Like, you want snakes in your yard. I mean, they will keep the rodent populations down. You want, you want spiders in your,
they eat mosquitoes
or bats or frogs. You know, they eat mosquitoes. So, you know, when we start tinkering with that balance and thinking, you know, wildlife's just inherently, they shouldn't be here, they're bad. But I understand the instinct of fright. I mean, it's sort of programmed into us, you know, that's, movement like that is bad. Or, again, if you're someone who encounters a 150-pound cat that's snarling, if you know mountain lion behavior, it probably isn't that much of a threat. But, of course, instinctually, if you don't, you're like, oh my God, this is something I should be afraid of. But I think learning more about our wild neighbors, learning the difference between a rattlesnake and a striped racer would do a lot, because people just tend to instinctually kill any snake.
Which is so sad.
It's so sad.
My gosh. They're so good. Like, I love that snake was on my front porch, because I don't think that they're doing that well here. So it's nice to see them.
Right.
Okay, because he was large too. Like, you could tell he was well fed. and B, that means I don't have any like rats in my backyard.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
They'll
like, I don't have any of those small rodents that he's probably munching on, which is great.
Yep. Wildlife can be really good neighbors if the coexistence balance is there.
It's like just as much as you're like, ugh, I don't want a snake in my bed. Like, you don't want to be in your bed. You know what
right,
I mean?
Exactly.
Like, you have to understand when you see a spider, if he's like hanging out around the door, I always just let them stay.
Right.
You know, police my doorway. Please keep the mosquitoes away. If there's one in my bed, if there's one that I see, which is rare, but if I see a bug where I'm like, I'm not too comfortable with this being there, I try my best. You don't even have to touch it. I don't like touching spiders.
You can buy spider scoopers that you can relocate them
or
very
you can do humanly. What I like to do is the cup move, where you put the cup over top and you slip a piece of paper under.
Right.
It's the easiest way to catch a bug. You never have to touch it. And then you can just very gently say, try to find a home in the backyard.
And just know your spiders. I had this is actually kind of a funny story. I had a spider in my house that had made a web, like, again, across my toaster. And I was like, okay, you need to leave. It didn't look like a black widow. It was, black widows are very easy to spot, at least the females.
Yeah, with the big bellies.
I just thought it was another benign, like, daddy long leg. So I literally picked it up in my hand and took it outside. But, of course, I took a photo first and posted it to my Facebook page. I was like, hey, does anybody know what the spider is? It was in my house. And my bug expert, that's a male black widow. And I'm like, oh, really? Oh, my God, they look so different than, I'm like, I picked it up.
I'm so glad it didn't bite me.
But it does show, and I've since, from that I learned, black widows are not aggressive. You have to be pinching, 75% of their body for them to, bite. So they're not, spiders are going to leap and bite you. So, I mean, again, knowing, black widows obviously are not something you want in the house. They're extremely poisonous and can really, but on the other hand, if you see one, it's not like you can have to be like, oh my God, it's going to leap. You have time to,
You can monitor. It's better to keep an eye on it, really. Figure out where it is. They even have these amazing toys for kids called bug vacuums. I don't know if you've ever seen these.
No.
You can buy them
on
Amazon or fun little science stores.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a gentle suction. It's shaped like a little gun with a gentle suction.
Mm-hmm.
And you can literally go around and vacuum up bugs. They sometimes have an observation tank in the end with a magnifier, so you can look at them under magnification.
Oh my God, I'll have to get one.
Yeah,
that
and then you can
great.
Just empty it out.
Empty it out.
Empty it out where it's more comfortable for you to have bugs living. Yeah. And
that's all you need to do.
That's all you have to do. Yeah.
And again, black widows, in safe spaces, they have an integral part of the food chain. They
for
also
sure.
eat you know, bugs that other bugs that we might not want around.
So. Yeah, I mean, they're definitely, and there's a reason they live here. Exactly. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we have brown widows that are really common here, and there's a reason for
ticks,
it.
Though, I haven't found, like, I feel the same way about mosquitoes. Justify ticks. Like, there's just no, like, at least mosquitoes, like, things eat them, right? But, like, ticks, I'm really trying to find, maybe the biologist can help me out. Like, what is the justification
for
ticks?
Yeah, it's like ticks and mosquitoes, I know they have there's gotta be space in the food chain, but I feel like they do so much more harm than them because they're vectors. And not just to humans. They make so many things sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm having a harder time justifying them. But I know they have a justification. I know they do.
the hippie that I am.
Exactly. There's got to be something. We need a PR campaign for ticks. You know,
so, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times, and I think probably the last thing I want to talk about before we close with my fame two questions is we've mentioned the wildlife crossing in passing.
Right.
I think it's very important to draw some attention to the idea of a wildlife crossing, what you're trying to do, and this big campaign with the wildlife crossing, and kind of obviously there are success stories.
Yeah. You know, I think like the stars have just aligned here, and I'm just so grateful to be working on this campaign. I mean, so many people have been working on connection in the Santa Monica Mountains and, you know, doing this through the National Wildlife Federation and sort of building on that work and taking this to the finish line. It's been the most amazing thing I've done in my career. And I've worked in Yellowstone. I've worked in Yosemite. This is just such a cool project. Inspirational as well. So what we're trying to do there is what we are going to do. I shouldn't say trying. Caltrans, we have them funded through 2017. And the good news is this project, there's no bad guy. Like it's both the easiest and the most challenging conservation work I've ever done. Mm-hmm. The easiest because there's no bad guy. The land's protected. Caltrans wants to do it. We enjoy almost unprecedented support. We had a public.
Yeah, no one's against it.
There's no like, you know, people united for the, you know, against the liberty. We get, some opposition, but, you know, we had a public meeting. Caltrans did their first public scoping, and I've been to many in my career, and it's always about 50-50. Not one voice in opposition, and the written letters that have come in, where that's where you really get it. I think it was like 98% of the couple thousand were favorite. It's not that there is an opposition, but it's just for the most part, people want this.
Yeah, it's I can't even see where there would be opposition except to say like, this is not where I would like to choose to spend my tax dollars.
Exactly. Yeah. And we address that in that we, for a couple reasons. One, to address that, we're going really after private philanthropists to address that. We're not taking money away from hospitals. Where we are using, I guess, you know, public dollars, it's funds that already have to be spent for conservation, right? So, but for the most part, this is, you know, we want the private philanthropists to step up. The other reason we're going after private money is, again, you know, public dollars can take a lot longer. These mountain lions are running out of time. So we want to get this done quickly. Our target date, I think we'll hit it, is 2021. And it really just is a matter of people writing checks. Again, there's no one to fight. But this crossing, what's remarkable about it, it'll be the largest in the world when built.
Wow.
10 lanes. I mean, there are crossings like this all over the world, and they're beautiful. They're not just bridges. They are extensions of green over the freeway.
Yeah, they almost look like if there were a natural overpass that grew over a freeway.
Yes, exactly. It's like so the parkland just grew over, and they work. I just toured one that they put up in Colorado. It's much smaller. It was only over a two-lane road. And the day after this thing was done, the deer started using it.
That's so cool.
And they reduce, you know, wildlife car collisions where they've been put in up to 80%.
They're not dumb, these animals. Like, their path of least resistance. If they're like, would I rather run across the freeway or just take this little bridge?
Yeah. They'll choose it. They will choose the green space. Interestingly enough, I learned through this project, birds will actually change their flight plan to fly over the green. They're more comfortable. So this crossing will benefit all species. And what they're looking at is putting, you know, a hiking trail and bike path for people as well. And one of the reasons that might work here is these animals are in the urban interface. Yeah. They're used to people. We're sharing trails already. So, you know, where it might be a little more of an impact, like in a Yellowstone.
Yeah, in the middle of Yellowstone, you might not do that.
The animals are used to having people around. So I think it's going to be a great sort of
That's
shared
cool.
space.
And they hack, right? The animals, like, I remember being down with Jeff Sickish and him, like, kind of showing me where the wildlife crossing is going to go. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, I was like, oh, they'd probably rather be in the brush and underneath it. And he was like, no, they take hiking trails.
Yeah.
Like, the animals see that, like, we've already plowed a path. And they're like, oh, that looks easy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to walk along that path.
Person I worked with in Yosemite who worked there for a long time, he's since retired, Jim Snyder, he used to build hiking trails. He said, we know we didn't do a good job if the deer don't use it.
Yeah.
Because like us, they want the easy way. You know,
yeah,
they're
they
not dumb.
Be like,
yeah.
like crawling on their exactly. bellies in a ropes course.
Yeah.
And it's the
mm-hmm.
same thing, like if they can find a drainage ditch under a freeway
exactly.
or some sort of weird little like area for mm-hmm. service, like they'll actually use
they will
it.
Use it. The mountain lions, there's a tunnel on the 118. They've mm-hmm. documented mountain lions and other animals using it. And that's why it is easy. One of the other, one of the stories in the book up near Yosemite where I live, Fishers, which is this cool sort of, I describe it as a combination between like a weasel and a fox or something. Extremely secretive. They've disappeared from 50% of their range. But they're having a hard time crossing roads up near Yosemite as well. Well, the researchers started noticing they were using culverts. So that's something where we don't have to, you know, that's not about building this huge infrastructure. That's just about retrofitting those
mm-hmm, yeah.
so that when the water does fill. So what they put is they put a ramp up above the water level so
Smart.
That these animals can,
they can
use
just
it.
Keep using it even
yeah.
and
so,
not drown.
So helping these animals, I say again, we have sort of the gold star, this huge multi-million-dollar project that'll set the world standard.
Yeah.
But it's also sometimes as simple as we said, plant milkweed or, you know, put a little ramp, you know, like I always say the easy one, put a little ramp out of your pool for the frogs,
yeah.
right? It's sometimes pretty simple stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he just wants to take a dip.
Just
he just
to
needs to be
dip.
Able to get back
exactly.
out. That's all. So, okay. Mm-hmm. I always close my podcast with two questions,
okay.
but I was just thinking in my head, I can kind of foresee that when people write about this episode,
mm-hmm.
they will have another two questions
okay.
that we didn't actually answer. So
okay.
short and sweet, these are the two questions I'm sure you get all the time. When we talk about P22, okay, he's only in 8 square miles. One, why don't we move him?
Yes, we get that question a lot. Mountain lion relocation is really successful. He could try to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's no mountain lion Shangri-La. I mean, there's no open space. So you're going to plop him down in a territory where there's another male, and one of them's probably going to die. I also get asked a lot, why don't you bring a girlfriend?
That was the other
was
one.
That the
like,
second
well, he's
one.
All alone. Why don't we just give him a date?
Griffith Park probably isn't big enough for two. Plus, you'd have to relocate Kate her out. And I gave a talk to some fifth graders recently, and they have names. They know them. Like, these kids ask, how's P45 doing? I love that, you know, school kids in L.A. follow these mountain lions. But one kid, he was very, you know, why don't you bring him a girlfriend? I said, well, have you ever been on a blind date? It, you know, it doesn't always work. And he thought for a little bit and he raised his hand. He's like, follow-up question. I'm like, sure. He's like, well, why don't you bring him three? You know?
That's
I
hilarious.
Said, you know, it doesn't work. But yeah, it just, you know, you'd have to relocate her and her kittens. It's not big enough to support.
And there's a chance he could fight her. There's
exactly.
a chance he could be
he
like,
could
I don't want
her.
You here.
Yeah.
I'm going to eat you so that I have more food.
Exactly.
Like, and then everybody would be like,
that is like, not like the people, you know, blind dates don't always
yeah.
work.
Luckily, so. We don't often get eaten by
yes,
our dates,
mates. Yes. So.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I'm glad we got that out
yeah,
of the way.
Okay.
All right. So I always close the podcast with the same two questions.
Okay.
And those two questions are pretty like big picture. So I
okay.
apologize up front.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. So we'll start with the more bummer one and we'll mm-hmm. end on the high note.
Okay.
In whatever context that matters to you, whether it's your work, whether it's your family, or whether it's like big global, you mm-hmm. know, stuff. The first question is, when you think about the future, what is kind of the thing that keeps you up the most at night, that really worries you, that you find yourself ruminating over? And then on the flip side of that, the second question, mm-hmm. so we end on a high note, is what are you most, you know, optimistic and hopeful for?
Right. You know, I think the thing that keeps me up at night that speaks to the disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I talk a lot about connectivity, which is probably the hopeful answer, but we just seem to be coming increasingly disconnected from each other, from wildlife, from natural spaces. And that worries me because I think that has repercussions for our existence on the planet. I don't I like to be a doomsayer. I think that one of the things we've done terribly in the environmental field is to say the world is ending and this is all bad. I mean, there's a lot of good, but I mean, you look at what's happening right now. Look at the floods in New Orleans, the fires that you can probably see the smoke outside your window.
Sad. Yeah, you get the ash, the layer of ash on your car.
Those are, I mean, climate change is playing a role in those. And we are becoming disconnected from our actions having an impact on the earth, on our fellow man and women, humans, and on wildlife. And that's what does keep me up at night, how to connect people mm-hmm. back to that so that we actually take some responsibility and actually think about the impact of what we do on others. Because when we talk about climate change and things like that, our behavior, most of us who are having the most impact are not suffering the most. Yeah. And with wildlife as well. Like, it just, we seem to be becoming increasingly disconnected from that. Like the stat that the average kid spends 7 minutes a day outside makes me cry.
That's insane.
And it's one of the things my organization tries to address. So that's what does keep me up at night, how to get people more connected.
And so there's got to be things that you experience in life. There's got to be something that kind of drives you and keeps you really hopeful. So what is that sort of feedback? What is that thing that makes you really optimistic about the future?
Yeah, I think, conversely, I do witness, I think in the same time we've become more disconnected, I think the hopeful trends are we're becoming more connected to each other. I think social media, which I know people bash a lot, I love that, I have friends I've actually never met, but that I, across the world. I love that, our population, is one of the things I love about California. We're so diverse here, mm-hmm. so that we become connected to each other in ways where, where I grew up, it was very segregated. It was just white people, and, there was one Chinese restaurant. And, I love that the world is changing, and that gives me hope that these differences, if we can get over this election, I think it's the last death throes of this, I don't want anything different.
It really is. It's putting it like center stage on the hot plate, which is good.
But I do think it's sort of it. I think if we get over that, I think I see a lot of hope in that we are celebrating our differences, but our connectedness because of that, whether it be with wildlife or with people, as I write in the book, there's a lot of cause for hope that we are looking at connections. It's just, I wish it would happen faster.
Yeah, and honestly, mm-hmm. I can't imagine your Save the LA Cougars campaign being as successful without social media. P22 has a Facebook page.
It would not. I mean, that's why people ask me why we're being successful. I take no credit. I take credit because I carry the cutout around. But it's him being having a relatable story. A psychologist told me a term, which is, she's like, people like him because he's a relatable victim.
Yeah.
And how do you tell his story? Social media. And I think social media has been, in fact, I write a lot about it in my book, like OR7. We didn't even touch on the wolves coming to California. Why did California do something unprecedented, vote to protect an animal that hadn't even set up permanent home in the state? Because everybody loved this journey they were following through social media. So I do think, P22 owes his celebrity to social media and just being a very handsome cat.
He's very handsome. You guys should totes follow him on Facebook.
Yes, follow him on Facebook. Yep.
So, Beth, the book is When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors. It's available everywhere.
Yep.
Beth does not get any proceeds from this guy. So buy the book. Buy it at your local bookstore.
Yeah. It's not just about mountain lions. There's wolves, porpoises, desert tortoise, foxes.
It doesn't have to be just the wherever you live in the country,
exactly.
Even in the world, really, these are relatable stories. Mm-hmm. And support the wildlife crossing, if you're interested, if you can, where can people go to
SaveLACougars.org. Yep.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And so that's through the National Wildlife Federation. Yep. And of course, if you join, and you pledge and all of that, you always get like the cool goodies. And
we get Save LA Cougars swag. And I will mention, we are having, please join us, P22 Day in Griffith Park. I am going to be hiking from the wildlife crossing to Griffith Park, leading with a bunch of others like
that
Jeff and
so far.
Miguel. 40 miles. And I'll be wearing the mountain lion collar, so you'll be able to track me online. And then it's a 3-day hike. I'll be with, Miguel and Jeff and others. Well, it's a group hike to show what he had to go through.
Oh my God. So are you going to cross the freeways?
We have been told by Caltrans we cannot. Yeah. We can't run across them. So we will take the safe crossing. But we're we're going to show what he pretty much, you know, symbolically had to do.
That's amazing.
And then we end October 22nd in Griffith Park, huge celebration called P22 Day. So join us.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I'm so excited. I will walk to meet you.
Yes, excellent.
Hopefully anybody who's local in LA will join, and mm-hmm. who isn't will be following online.
You can follow online. Yep, cool. Exactly.
And if people want to reach out to you specifically mm-hmm. in social media, where can they find you on, like, Twitter, all that good stuff?
Yeah, Beth Pratt 1 is my Facebook, and Facebook is just always a great way to communicate. Mm-hmm. Beth Pratt for Twitter. Those are probably the two easiest ways to find me.
Yep. Great. Mm-hmm. All right, guys. So check out the book. Check out The Wildlife Crossing. Say hi to Beth. Thank her for an
amazing
show.
Thanks for having me. It's always so fun to chat with you.
It was so much fun. Yeah. Oh, and congratulate her on her first podcast interview.
Yes, this is my first podcast. I was afraid I'd screw it up, but
oh no, you
were
amazing. You're amazing. And guys, thank you so much for joining me week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.